Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of them were published in April of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this title from the politics section, The RFK Curious Women of Bucks County. What I heard from some crucial voters who are far from happy about their choice of presidential candidates, by Elaine Godfrey. Everyone loves Lynn. At least, that's what all her friends kept telling me last week as they filed through Lynn's front door in the Philadelphia suburbs and sipped Chardonnay in her crowded kitchen. When you meet her, you see why. Lynn Kelleher, a 66-year-old Bucks County realtor, is utterly charming. Her pointed questions take you by surprise, and her impressive range of swear words makes you laugh until you snort. Kelleher's magnetism is why I reached out to her in the first place. Through her work and the local charity group she funded, she has more friends than she can count. Pennsylvania, again, will be one of a handful of battleground states that will determine the outcome of the upcoming presidential election. And I'd been searching for women in the area to discuss that with. Kelleher was the ideal person to convene my own personal focus group of educated suburbanites, a crucial segment of the electorate that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are competing for in November. The problem for the two candidates? None of these women likes either of them. I'd already assumed as much based on poll numbers, but these suburbanites dislike their options with an intensity that was almost startling. If other swing state voters feel similarly, the long-ordained Trump-Biden rematch could be even more volatile than expected. Last week, Kelleher invited me to talk politics over wine and pizza with her and seven of her friends. The group, which ranged in age from 37 to 69, was not a scientifically representative sample. Everyone was white, and most either inclined to the center or leaned right. All were frankly disgusted with their current choices. Trump is repugnant, the women agreed, while most of them viewed Biden as ancient and incoherent. Believe it or not, I'm hoping one of them drops dead before the election, one told me. Trump has long struggled to attract suburban women, and Biden's lead among women generally is narrower with this demographic. At this point, 7 months out, Bucks County women are not looking like an easy get for either party. About half of Kelleher's circle told me they were casting about for an alternative. A few of them had either settled on or were curious about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the one-time Democrat who is now running as an independent. I need to check out Kennedy further, one woman said at the end. I'm starting to go, whoa, there's another option here? Kelleher's living room is painted bright turquoise, and the chairs are upholstered in orange paisley. The legs of her hall table, displaying vintage pillbox hats, end in gold high heels. You get the picture. The women sat in a circle, munching on pizza and getting a little tipsy, until the time came for me to ruin the mood. So, how are we all feeling about the election? The answer was a resounding, not great. I don't want to sound melodramatic, but I am so disturbed by the political climate in this country, Kelleher said. She'd voted for Trump in 2016, but disgusted by his behavior, switched her vote to Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate in 2020. We've lost our center, added George Ann Ford, a 62-year-old career coach, sitting next to her, who voted for Trump in 2020. I think about what's written on our coins, in God we trust, We've lost that. Tara, who is in her early 60s and asked to use her first name only for privacy reasons, sighed. This is the best the United States can do, she asked? That we have no viable candidate other than Biden and Trump? It's sad. Kelleher and her friends are the kind of well-educated, well-dressed women you'd expect to find in this affluent suburb north of Philadelphia. Some wore heels, many had fresh manicures, most of them had voted Republican before Trump, some also voted for Trump, but they've been disappointed by what they believe Trump has brought to American politics, a lack of civility and never-ending culture wars that have seeped into school board meetings and interactions with neighbors. Suddenly, it's okay to do the name-calling. It's okay to say things that are blatantly untrue, Kelleher said. Trump gives those people that have been living under rocks permission to come out and see the light. January 6th was a national nightmare, they agreed. They had been relieved when Republican leaders criticized the former president. And then the subsequent day, you hear all those, pardon my French, pussies backpedal from it, Kelleher said. That's the problem with Trump. He's a bully, Tara said. Democracy won't go away if Trump wins, said Laura Henderson, a 35-year-old stay-at-home mom who voted for Biden in 2020. But she believes it's on the ballot in November because Trump sees himself as a supreme ruler. He's a Putin lover, Kelleher said. He would like it to be him on horseback without a shirt on. Tina, who also declined to share her last name for privacy reasons, saw Trump's foreign policy differently. She'd voted for him in 2020 and felt his leadership style was effective, if crude. He's so freaking crazy that everyone's afraid of him, she said. Several of the women gave Trump credit on domestic issues. Things didn't cost so much when he was president, they agree. And small businesses were doing better. The migrants who made it across the U.S.-Mexico border were sent back, they believed, instead of being allowed to roam the country. The women talked a lot about feeling safe in their homes because they are only 2 hours' drive from New York City, which has recently seen a large influx of migrants. Trump, they said, would do a better job than Biden at locating those who have committed crimes and deporting them. And how many terrorist cells are in New York or Chicago or Colorado, Tina said. But what about all the criminal indictments against Trump? I think he's guilty, Tara said with a shrug. She had voted for him twice. If you're repulsive, you're repulsive. So why not vote for Biden then, I ask. A few in the group rolled their eyes. They were mad about housing costs and gas prices. But more important, they said, is that Biden just seems so old. I was hoping after that report came out in February, where the conclusion was he's an elderly man with a bad memory, that maybe the party would step up and say, we've got to find somebody else, Tara said, referring to Special Counsel Robert Hur's investigation of Biden's mishandling of classified documents. In a way, these women seemed to feel like they'd been conned. Biden had pledged to be a bridge candidate back in 2020, and they'd taken him at his word. He put himself out there as his segue to the next generation, as a palate cleanser, Henderson told me. But now he still wants to be president? And here we are, Kelleher said. Joe, step the hell down, man. Most of the women had positive feelings about Pennsylvania's Democratic governor, Josh Shapiro, who differs little from Biden politically, but is more than 30 years younger. Why couldn't someone like him run for president against Trump? The Biden campaign is banking on reproductive rights being a motivating force again in this election, as it was in the 2020 midterms. But this factored in only a few of these women. Ford, the career coach, had volunteered for Rachel's Vineyard, a pro-life organization offering support to women who have had abortions. She'd voted for Trump in the past, she said, if only to support further anti-abortion legislation. Kelleher, who describes herself as pro-choice, was puzzled. Even though you know that if, in one of Trump's various and assorted affairs, if one of his girlfriends came back pregnant, he'd send her to get an abortion. I do know that, Ford said. Probably to the opposite of you, I will vote for Biden to support abortion rights, Henderson said, even though I don't want to. I was struck by how unfailingly civil they were to one another, even when disagreements were sharp. The frustrating thing about voting, they said, is that a ballot offers no opportunity to register a nuanced point of view. You can't add a qualifier to your choice that says, hated January 6th, though. Which has led to some of them feeling judged for their choice. If you say that you voted for Trump to win the last election, Tina said, you're almost put in the same category as the people that stormed the Capitol. Delana Fiadino, a 58-year-old hypnotherapist who voted for Biden in 2020, was itching to step in to explain all of this. Everything we'd been talking about is why she's voting for Kennedy this time around. It's sad because he's painted to be a kook, but he's not, she said. He's fought big pharma, major corporations. He's for good soil, for our foods, our health. And she insisted he was not an anti-vaxxer. Kennedy has consistently questioned vaccine safety and efficacy. But how do you feel about the facts that he most likely won't win? Henderson asked. I think he most likely will, Fiadino said. I don't think they're telling us the way it is, because they want this. They want us to think there's a two-party option, and that's it. Right now, Kennedy has collected only enough signatures to get on the ballot in a handful of states, but his campaign has pledged to get him on the ballot in all 50 before November 5th. In national polling, Kennedy stands at about 12%, which makes him the highest-scoring third-party candidate since Ross Perot. In a three-way race against Biden, Trump, and Kennedy, some polls show RFK's candidacy making a Trump victory more likely. But Kennedy could pull votes away from Trump, too, if some of his own former voters are disillusioned, as my non-representative sample suggested. Kelleher was nodding as Fiadino spoke. Everyone also says that voting for a third party is wasting your vote and spoiling the outcome, Kelleher said. But damn it, if nobody steps up and gets counted, how do things ever change? If she had to vote right now, she said, it'd be Kennedy, for sure. Tara and Tina would likely vote for Trump. Henderson was solidly pro-Biden. Joyce Merriman, a 69-year-old realtor who supports abortion rights, had voted for Trump in 2020, but said she'd have to think about it this time. Maybe she'd read a little more about Kennedy at home. Ford said she would too, which is when I began to wonder if my little focus group had incubated a whole new batch of Kennedy supporters. Of course, their answers may simply reflect the fact that many Americans haven't yet started thinking seriously about the election. Then again, this may indicate what could happen when they do. The sun had set on Bucks County hours ago. The bottles of wine were empty, and we'd started gathering empty glasses and plates. Kelleher looked around the room. So much can happen before the election, she said. Maybe 7 months would be enough time for something, anything, to give dissatisfied voters some reason for optimism. I just think we are the majority, Kelleher said to the group. There's so many people like us. And that completes the first article. The title was The RFK Curious Women of Bucks County, by Atlantic staff writer Elaine Godfrey. The next article's title comes to us from the health section, Almost No One is Happy with Legal Weed. Will Legal Psychedelics Be Any Better? By Jane Hugh, a science journalist from Seattle. The legalization of cannabis in the United States, the biggest challenge in policy for an illegal substance since Prohibition ended, has been an unqualified success for approximately no one. True, the drug is widely available for commercial purchase. Many marijuana-related charges have been dropped, and stoner culture has become more aligned with designer smoking paraphernalia featured on Goop than the bumbling spaciness of Cheech and Chong. But a significant part of the market is still underground. Medical research is scant, and the above-ground market is not exactly thriving. Longtime marijuana activists are unhappy. Entrepreneurs are unhappy. So are people who buy weed, as well as those who think weed should never have been legal in the first place. The country is now poised to change the legal status of a new class of psychoactive drugs, psychedelics. They have shown early promise in treating mental health issues, even though some enthusiasts are concerned that easing regulations without a better understanding of these drugs could put patients in a degree of danger. Oregon is now licensing centers that can administer psilocybin, and MDMA is moving toward FDA approval. In some ways, fate of legalized pot could be read as a cautionary tale for how these drugs, too, could be left in a limbo that hardly anyone really likes. But as psychedelics enter the mainstream, becoming decriminalized, state legal, or even FDA approved, they will be dispensed and sold differently from marijuana. The process is unlikely to please everyone, but if advocates, manufacturers, and lawmakers can keep psychedelics from falling into the same traps that marijuana did, they have a chance of creating an industry that serves at least some Americans well. Despite its wide availability, cannabis is still illegal under federal law. Since 1970, it's been listed as a Schedule I drug, meaning the government believes it carries a high likelihood of abuse and no medical value. Starting in the 1970s, states began passing laws lowering penalties for cannabis possession and allowing it for medical purposes and eventually recreational use. In 2013, U.S. Deputy Attorney General James M. Cole issued a memo declaring that the Justice Department would not strictly enforce federal marijuana laws in states that legalized it. Americans were eager to buy marijuana as states launched legalization programs. But in most states, cannabis hasn't proved to be a great legal business. Because cannabis is still illegal at the federal level, many entrepreneurs don't benefit from many of the tax breaks that other businesses do, meaning the industry essentially pays billions in extra taxes, according to an analysis by a cannabis research firm. In most states, big corporations dominate the industry, while small business owners struggle to afford high licensing fees. One promise of legalization was its potential benefit to Black and Latino communities, who were disproportionately affected by the war on drugs. But, as of 2017, members of these communities accounted for single-digit percentages of state-sanctioned cannabis entrepreneurs. Because legal weed is sometimes more expensive than old-school dealer prices, plenty of people simply stick with the unregulated underground. In states like New York, the gap between what's legal and what's enforced has allowed illicit stores to pop up among the legitimate ones. That's all in places where recreational use is legal. In the 14 states where only medical use is allowed, dispensaries must make a different calculus. They serve patients in need, but others treat them only as a loophole to access the drug and are likely to go elsewhere if recreational access becomes available. In the 12 states where even medical marijuana is illegal, the only cannabis products legally available are a handful of medications that have been approved by the FDA, all for a narrow set of indications, such as vomiting among chemotherapy patients, AIDS-related anorexia, and certain kinds of seizures. Active clinical trials to study cannabis are few and far between, which means that the drug currently has no clear pathways to be federally approved for other indications. Psychedelics are much further behind in their journey to wider availability, but on the surface they appear poised to mimic marijuana. The drugs are undergoing a sea change in public sentiment. Aaron Rodgers has a trip story, and so does Michael Bublé. Half of state governments have introduced psychedelics-related bills, some of them to form working groups that will dig into the science of psychedelics, and some to launch full-blown psilocybin industries. Assuming that reform moves at a comparable speed to cannabis, researchers have estimated that 25 states could legalize psychedelics in the next decade or so. Voters in Oregon and Colorado have already passed ballot initiatives that opened the way for psilocybin industries in their states. But instead of following marijuana's trajectory for reform, first decriminalization, then medical legitimacy, followed by recreational use, psychedelics are barreling down all those avenues at once. State-regulated psilocybin centers are shaping up to be less like cannabis dispensaries and more like a hybrid of a psychotherapy office, a medical clinic, and a spa. Rules in the psilocybin industry are much more restrictive than those for cannabis ever were, because many people believe unlocking the possible benefits of these drugs requires more careful support and perceive the risks of a bad trip as higher. Whereas Oregonians over 21 can pop into a dispensary, flash an ID, and take their bud, or gummies, or soda, or cookies, home, adults seeking psilocybin must undergo a comprehensive mental and physical health screening, then ingest their dose under the supervision of a trained and licensed facilitator. Meanwhile, researchers and startups are pushing psychedelics forward on the medical front. We might see the first MDMA approval to treat PTSD as soon as August. This air of legitimacy, the idea that psychedelics could be more serious drugs than cannabis, gives drugs like MDMA and psilocybin certain advantages. Psychedelics research is booming in a way that marijuana research never really has. Few scientists have overcome the hurdles of studying cannabis. For instance, by most accounts, the government-grown weed that researchers have to use is less potent than what's sold at dispensaries, and has been known to arrive in labs already moldy. And with the thriving black market, pharmaceutical companies have seemed uninterested in sponsoring cannabis clinical trials. But for psychedelics, which support much less illegal trade, startups and nonprofits are leaning hard into the clinical trial route. Sue Sisley, a physician and marijuana researcher who previously developed clinical trials for marijuana, says psychedelics have moved toward legalization so quickly, in large part because they're following Big Pharma's traditional drug development playbook. In some ways, the FDA-forward approach is a gamble for people hoping to create a psychedelics industry. For one thing, Ariel Clark, an Anishinaabe cannabis and psychedelics attorney, worries that this pathway could put the drugs firmly out of legal reach for the people who could most benefit from the protections that come with legalization, including the indigenous communities that already use some psychedelics in traditional ceremonies. Currently, a single psilocybin session at an Oregon service center costs thousands. Companies that receive FDA approval could possibly further inflate the prices of approved psychedelics and treatment. That has already happened with ketamine. Additionally, FDA approval of proprietary psychedelics might still leave growers paying the same high taxes that have caused small cannabis business owners to fold. Farmers already have really low margins, and taxes don't help, says Hadass Alterman, a partner at Plant Medicine Law Group and a member of Oregon's Psilocybin Advisory Board's Equity Subcommittee. But even in a scenario that leaves small-time entrepreneurs in the dust, some advocates argue that medicalization would be a net good. Medicalization might not lead the United States to a hallucinogenic utopia, but compared with underground use, it very well could increase access to psychedelics, improve patient safety, and build a functional, if inequitable, industry. Psychedelics manufacturers and people with the means to afford their pricey treatments might be perfectly happy with that outcome. Psychedelics are still in uncharted territory in the U.S., even though startups are investing millions on the assumption that they'll be approved as medicines, and state-run programs are charging ahead with developing their own psychedelic industries. Research on the drugs is still in early days, and their exact path to legalization remains murky. But at the very least, lawmakers have a great model of what not to do. Folks sitting in government saw what happened with cannabis, Clark told me. One can only assume that they don't want to repeat the experience. That's the end of the article. The title was Almost No One is Happy with Legal Weed by Jane C. Hugh. I'll take a moment to remind everyone that's listening, particularly those that have joined late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sunsounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles that were published in April on the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. The third article today is coming to us from the global section of the magazine. The United States and Israel are coming apart. The disagreements aren't just over tactics, they've become fundamental. By Hussein Ibish. A rift has opened between Israel and the United States. No breach between the two countries has been as wide or as deep since the mid-1950s, when the Eisenhower administration compelled Israel to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula. President Joe Biden expressed grave displeasure with Israel this week over the strike that killed 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen, and a phone call between him and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday was reportedly tense. But those are just the surface-level fissures that emanate from a much more profound split. Washington and Jerusalem don't just differ over tactics, nor even just over plans for the medium term. For the first time in modern memory, the two countries are also at odds over long-term visions and goals, as Israel's territorial ambitions are coming into ever greater and more direct conflict with U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East. Last week, the Biden administration abstained from a U.N. Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza war. an abstention by a Security Council permanent member amounts to a yes vote, because a no vote constitutes a veto. To demonstrate his displeasure, Netanyahu canceled a White House visit by some of his most senior advisors. The de facto yes vote on the ceasefire resolution was a long time coming. For months, the Biden administration has been slowly building pressure on Israel, starting with calls for brief pauses in the fighting to allow humanitarian aid transfers. The administration then pressed for longer-term truce proposals, including the 10-day halt in fighting, during which women and children captives were exchanged. More recently, First Vice President Kamala Harris and then Biden himself have called explicitly for a ceasefire. The abstention last week leaves Israel standing alone before the international community's now unanimous demand for the fighting to stop, at least temporarily. Israeli denial of humanitarian aid to Gazans is another source of tension that has come to a head. The Karim Shalom crossing into Gaza is the only one equipped to handle major shipments of goods into the territory, and Israel has failed to open it in a meaningful way for aid transfers. Israel has turned the basic human needs of civilians in Gaza into an instrument of pressure in hostage negotiations with Hamas. In his State of the Union address on March 7th, Biden bluntly warned Israel that humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. The United States and its partners have tried to circumvent Israeli obstruction by loading boxes of goods onto trucks at the Egyptian crossing near Rafah, by airdropping aid into Gaza. Now the U.S. military is building a temporary pier off the coast to get supplies into Gaza more efficiently. By doing so, the United States and its partners are effectively going around Israel and undercutting an important part of its negotiating strategy. On March 14th, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urged Israel to hold new elections as soon as possible because Netanyahu has lost his way, has become an obstacle to peace, and threatens to turn Israel into a para among nations. These striking remarks from a Biden ally suggest a desire to frame the rift as political, a dispute between leaders and personalities with different perspectives. But the split between the United States and Israel runs much deeper than that and will be much harder to resolve. The most immediate dispute between Washington and Jerusalem concerns the next tactical phase of the Gaza war. The Israeli offense began in the north of Gaza and has pushed all the way to the outskirts of the southernmost city of Rafah on the Egyptian border. Israelis are virtually unanimous in insisting that they cannot consider military operations complete until the remaining Hamas battalions, as well as commanders and even hostages, are rooted out of that city. In the abstract, the Biden administration agrees that Hamas remnants and assets in Rafah are a valid target. But Israel's drive from the north has also pushed Gaza's civilians south. Approximately 1.4 million Palestinians now huddle in tent encampments surrounding Rafah. With the Egyptian border closed to them, they have literally nowhere to go. The Biden administration has told Israel that before assaulting Rafah, it must find these civilians a haven with at least minimal shelter, food, and potable water, if not basic medical care. Israel claims to be working on a plan, but the Biden administration appears distinctly unimpressed with its progress. How and when Israel proceeds into Rafah is a short-term tactical dispute. In the medium term, Israel and the Biden administration have a strategic difference over the prospect of an Israeli offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is probably one of the most potent non-state fighting forces in human history and the most serious immediate military threat to Israel. Its estimated 150,000 rockets and missiles, many with precision guidance, are capable of striking any target in Israel and could probably overwhelm the Iron Dome anti-missile system. Hawkish members of the Israeli War Cabinet, most notably Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, have been pressing for a preemptive strike against Hezbollah since the first days after the October 7th Hamas-led attack. Daily skirmishes have caused fatalities on both sides, particularly among the Lebanese. But Hezbollah has made clear in word and deed that it does not want a broader war with Israel at the moment. Nonetheless, Israel appears to be preparing for a major ground offensive into Lebanon in the spring or early summer. At least it is trying to convey that impression. Such an invasion could be the prelude to precisely what the Biden administration has been striving to avoid since October 7th, a regional conflagration that could draw in the United States and Iran. Tehran doesn't want this either, but other actors would be happy to see the war go regional. These include some of the militias in Iran's Axis of Resistance network, such as Hamas and some Iraqi groups, but not Hezbollah and a strong faction within Israel's war cabinet. An expanded war would certainly be bad for the United States, Hezbollah, and Iran, but it might be good for Israel, the company's hawks surmise. By their logic, if a decisive victory is not achievable in Gaza, a war in Lebanon could yet restore Israeli deterrence, damage Iran's deeper strategic interests, and possibly initiate a spiraling conflict that could lead the U.S. to strike Iran and its nuclear facilities. The Biden administration thus faces the vexing problem of having its most important policy goal regarding the Gaza crisis challenged and perhaps derailed by its primary regional partner. The near and medium-term disagreements between Washington and Jerusalem are significant, but the true scope of the rift comes into view only from the highest altitude. The United States and Israel have divergent visions for the future of the region, Israel's identity and borders, and U.S. strategic interests. Virtually every major U.S. goal in the Middle East requires a strong, integrated, U.S.-led alliance that combines Israeli military capability with Saudi financial, cultural, and religious authority. Such was the thinking behind the Israeli-Saudi normalization agreement that was on the cusp of success just before October 7th. The war in Gaza prompted Saudi Arabia to freeze those negotiations, but by early January, senior Saudi officials signaled interest in reviving the deal, provided that Israel accept the Palestinian right to a state and help create the framework for establishing one. The United States, and really the entire international community, has also concluded that any resolution to this nearly 100-year-old conflict must involve a Palestinian state alongside Israel. But Israel is charging headlong the other way. Not only Netanyahu, but his whole cabinet and a large Knesset majority reject the idea of a two-state solution. Israel has never formally recognized the Palestinian right to a state or entered into any process that defined the establishment of one as its end goal. Rather, since the mid-1990s, Israel first slowly and then rapidly moved in the opposite direction, toward annexing large parts of the occupied West Bank, which would render Palestinian statehood practically unattainable. This anti-peace agenda is now the official position of the Israeli government, not just Likud or other right-wing parties. The Trump administration endorsed it in 2020 with the Peace to Prosperity proposal, which envisaged Israel annexing 30% more of the West Bank, including all of the Jordan Valley, such that any potential Palestinian entity would be entirely surrounded by a greater Israel. Senior ministers in the current Israeli cabinet have gone so far as to speak not only of annexing Gaza, but of removing Palestinians from the territory. The U.S. and Israel have a tactical disagreement about Rafah and a medium-term strategic one about Lebanon. Over a Palestinian state, however, the breach is visionary. The desire for Israeli expansion to include much of the occupied West Bank has not become a full consensus view in Israel, but enough Israelis support it. As much as half of the public, according to a poll from 2020, that no government is likely to move decisively against it. A slower walk toward this disaster is probably the best that Israeli politics can produce. Israel has come to a fork in the road. It can consolidate its affiliation with Washington and strengthen it through partnerships with Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries, or it can commit to illegally gobbling up occupied territory, expelling many Palestinians in the process, and denying citizenship to those who remain. If it chooses the latter course, the opportunity for a broader Middle Eastern alliance will slip away. So might the American people. Right-wing evangelicals and Orthodox Jews may be sympathetic to the expansionist project, but many other Americans, including Jewish Americans, see it as illegitimate and profoundly unjust. Their misgivings will flow into the already existing consensus that Israeli intransigence on the Palestinian issue is disastrous for American interests in the region. So the split between the United States and Israel that is obvious over Rafah in the moment, imminent over Lebanon for the spring and summer, and seemingly irreconcilable over annexation versus Palestinian independence in the long term, becomes all the more cavernous as the aperture widens. The United States and Israel both oppose Iranian hegemony in the Middle East. But unless Israel changes its position on Palestinian statehood, that may be the only place where U.S. and Israeli interests coincide. That's the end of the article. The author, Hussein Abish, is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. The name of his article was "The United States and Israel Are Coming Apart." This next article comes to us from the technology section. What Neuralink is missing? It turns out that connecting brains with computers is the easy part. By S.I. Rosenbaum. Until recently in all of human history, the number of true cyborgs stood at about 70. Ian Burkhart has kept a count because he was one of them, a person whose brain has been connected directly to a computer. Burkhart had become quadriplegic in a swimming accident after a wave ran him into a sandbar and injured his spine. He was later able to receive an implant from a research study which allowed him to temporarily regain some movement in one hand. For 7.5 years he lived with this device, an electrode array nestled into his motor cortex that transmitted signals to a computer, which then activated electrodes wrapped around his arm. Burkhart now heads the BCI Pioneers Coalition, an organization for the small cohort of other disabled people who have volunteered their brain to push the boundaries of brain-computer interface technology, or BCI. Last month, Burkhart, along with perhaps millions of other people, watched the debut of the newest cyborg. In a video posted on X, the first human subject for Elon Musk's BCI company, Neuralink, appeared to control a laptop via brain implant. Neuralink has not published its research and did not respond to a request for comment, but the device presumably works this way. The subject, a paralyzed 29-year-old named Noland Arbaugh, generates a pattern of neural activity by thinking about something specific, like moving the cursor on his computer screen or moving his hand. The implant then transmits that pattern of neural signals to the computer, where an AI algorithm interprets it as a command that moves the cursor. Because the implant purportedly allows a user to control a computer with their thoughts, more or less, Musk named the device Telepathy. Burkhart watched Arbaugh play hands-free computer chess with a mix of approval and frustration at how clearly the demo was created for investors and Musk fans, not for disabled people like him. It's no secret that Musk's real goal is to create a BCI device for general consumers, and not just so we can move a cursor around. He envisions a future in which humans can access knowledge directly from computers to achieve a symbiosis with artificial intelligence. That dream is ethically fraught. Privacy, for instance, is tricky when your thoughts are augmented by proprietary algorithms, but it is also a long way from being realized. Researchers have sort of managed two-way information transfer with rats, but no one is sure how the rats felt about it, or whether it's an experience they'd be willing to pay for at a mall kiosk. Yet, a more modest vision for a safe, workable neuroprosthesis that would allow disabled people to use a computer with ease is realizable. The question is whether our social structures are ready to keep pace with our advanced science. It's taken decades for BCI tech to get to this point, decades of scientists building prototypes by hand, and of volunteers who could neither move nor speak, struggling to control them. The most basic challenge in mating a brain and a computer is an incompatibility of materials. Though computers are made of silicone and copper, brains are not. They have a consistency not unlike tapioca pudding. They wobble. The brain also constantly changes as it learns, and it tends to build scar tissue around intrusions. You can't just stick a wire into it. Different developers have tried different solutions to this problem. Neuralink is working on flexible filaments that thread inconspicuously, they hope, through the brain tissue. Precision Neuroscience, founded in part by former Neuralink scientists, is trying out a kind of electrode-covered saran wrap that clings to the surface of the brain or slips into its folds. Then there's the Utah Array, a widely used model that looks a little like a hairbrush with its bristly pad of silicone spikes. That's what Burkhart had in his head until 2021, when the study he was part of lost funding, and he decided to have the implant taken out. He was worried surgeons might have to remove chunks of brain along with it. Luckily, he told me, it came out without too much of a fight. Once an implant is in place, the tiny signals of individual neurons, measurable in microvolts, have to be amplified, digitized, and transmitted, preferably by a unit that's both wireless and inconspicuous. That's problem number two. Problem three is decoding those signals. We have no real idea of how the brain talks to itself, so a machine learning algorithm has to use a brute force approach, finding patterns in neural activity and learning to correlate them with whatever the person with the implant is trying to make the computer do. None of these problems is trivial, but they've been substantially tackled over the past 30 years of BCI research. At least 6 different companies are now testing applications such as desktop interfaces, like the one that helped Arbaugh play chess, drivers for robotic limbs and exoskeletons, and even speech prosthesis that gives voice to thought. Proof of concept devices exist for all of those by now. But that only brings us to problem number 4, which has nothing to do with engineering and might be harder to solve than all the others. This problem is what Ben Rappaport, the chief science officer at Precision, described to me as the productization of science. It's where engineering successes run into political and economic obstacles. To roll out even a basic point-and-click medical BCI interface, developers would have to win approval, not just from the FDA, but also from payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance companies. This is make or break. Medical advices, even ingenious ones, won't get to consumers if insurance won't cover them. Few people can afford such expenses out of pocket, which means too small a pool of potential consumers to make production profitable. Other devices have cleared this hurdle. Cochlear implants, deep brain stimulation devices, pacemakers, and it's not unlikely that BCI implants could join that list of if insurers decide they're worth the expense. On the one hand, insurance companies might argue that BCI devices aren't strictly medically necessary. They're life-enhancing, not life-sustaining, as Burkhart put it. On the other hand, insurers are likely to see them as cost-efficient if their implementation can save money on other, more expensive kinds of support. Even so, there's a limit to what brain implants can do and what they can replace. The people who would benefit most from BCI devices, people with major motor impairments like Arbaugh and Burkhart, would still depend on human labor for many things, such as getting in and out of bed, bathing, dressing, and eating. That labor can easily cost as much as 6 figures a year, and isn't typically reimbursed by private health insurance companies. For most people, the only insurer that covers this kind of care is Medicaid, which in most states comes with stringent restrictions on recipients' income and assets. In Ohio, where Burkhart lives, Medicaid recipients can't keep more than $2,000 in assets or make more than $943 a month without losing coverage. A waiver program raises the monthly income cap to $2,829. The salary they'd have to make to cover both expenses and in-home care out of pocket, though, is much more than most jobs pay. A lot of people don't have the opportunity to make such a giant leap, Burkhart said. The system is set up to force you to live in poverty. In addition to his work with the BCI Pioneers Coalition, Burkhart also leads a nonprofit foundation that fundraises to help people with disabilities cover some of the expenses insurance won't pay. But these expenses would be nowhere near the size that would pay to get a BCI or anything like that, he told me. We do a lot of shower chairs or hand controls for a vehicle. Starting in the late 20th century, Simply Switch devices began to enable people with severe motor disabilities to access computers. As a result, many people who would previously have been institutionalized, those who can't speak, for example, or move most of their body, are able to communicate and use the Internet. BCI has the potential to be much more powerful than switch access, which is slow and janky by comparison. Yet the people who receive the first generation of medical implants may find themselves in the same position as those who use switch technology now, functionally required to stay unemployed, poor, or even single as a condition of accessing the services keeping them alive. Musk may be right. We're quickly approaching a time when BCI tech is practical and even ubiquitous. But right now we don't have a social consensus on how to apportion resources such as health care, and many disabled people still lack the basic supports necessary to access society. These are problems that technology alone will not and cannot solve. That completes the article. The title was What Neuralink is Missing by S.I. Rosenbaum. That also completes the broadcast today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your SunSounds volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the online edition, all dated April of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premier programming offered by SunSounds. And if you've missed an article or a program that you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast and audio info, and then click on demand. You'll see a list of the articles available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.